This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو منه من قرآن وما تتلو وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
Headlines: classified documents are found at former U.S. Vice President Pence's home, and the latest discovery of secret files at the homes of officials who served in top ranks. Peru's president calls for a national truce to end weeks of unrest, saying protests have so far caused over $1 million in damage. And also, North Korea places the capital Pyongyang on a 5-day lockdown over rising cases of an unspecified respiratory illness. Our top story for this half hour. We begin with the United States, where former Vice President Mike Pence is the latest high-ranking politician to be put into the spotlight for the discovery of classified documents. The documents were found at Pence's Indiana residence and turned over to the FBI last week. His representative says a small number of records were accidentally boxed and transported to his home as he left office in 2021. It's not clear what information the documents contain. The discovery comes in the wake of similar revelations about classified material discovered in President Joe Biden's private office and also the Florida residence of former President Donald Trump. Records from each administration are supposed to be turned over to the legal custody of the U.S. National Archives during a presidential transition period. It's unlawful to knowingly remove or retain classified material. U.S. President Joe Biden is once again urging Congress to ban assault weapons after back-to-back deadly shootings across the country.
And we're working out a number of things that we can and are going to be doing. So the bottom line here is that we got a lot to talk about. And yesterday, my buddy Dianne Feinstein introduced her Senate assault weapons ban. I am asking you all to send that to my desk as quickly as you can.
Several states, including California, Ohio, and Washington, have experienced shooting incidents in recent weeks. The deadliest unfolded in California, where 3 separate gun assaults left 24 people dead. Figures from a research database, the Gun Violence Archive, show there have been more than 600 mass shootings in the United States in the last 3 years, almost 2 a day on average. Biden's push for a ban on assault weapons is not likely to bear results, as Republicans now in control of the House of Representatives are mostly opposed to such measures. The Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution gives Americans a right to bear arms, and about a third of adults in the country say they personally own a gun. The U.S. administration has granted a license to Trinidad and Tobago to develop a major gas field located in Venezuela's territorial waters. The move marks a further easing of some of Washington's sanctions on Caracas. The U.S. Treasury said it issued the license at the request of Trinidad. The license allows the island nation to do business with Venezuela's heavily sanctioned state-run oil company, PDVSA. This is a Venezuelan company has found reserves of 4.2 trillion cubic feet in the area. U.S. officials say granting the license helps ensure energy security and reduces the region's reliance on energy resources from other countries, including Russia. Western countries have seen an increasing scarcity in oil and gas supplies exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. The easing of oil sanctions on Venezuela is also seen as an extension of Western efforts to tap into the country's vast oil and gas reserves. Peru's president has called for a national truce to end weeks of unrest against the backdrop of demands for her resignation and fresh allegations.
We call for a truce. We call the Congress, and now I call my dear homeland, for a national truce to establish the dialogue tables and, better still, to be able to set the agenda for each region and develop our peoples.
President Boluarte said she will not back down from the path of dialogue, peace, and unity. The Peruvian head of state ruled out resignation, but said she has no intention for remaining in power. Boluarte said weeks of deadly protests have resulted in more than $1.3 billion in damage. The protests in Peru began in December after then-president Pedro Castillo was arrested and replaced by Vice President Dina Boluarte. Protesters also want Castillo released. Some 50 people have been killed during the disturbances. Brazil's federal police are investigating a, quote, genocide in the Yanomami territory, the country's largest indigenous reservation. The probe comes after a government report revealed nearly 100 Yanomami children died last year from malnutrition, pneumonia, and malaria. The deaths are linked to massive gold mining activity in the region. The use of mercury by miners to separate gold from sediment has contaminated rivers and fish in the area. The Justice Ministry says the probe will consider possible environmental crimes. Brazil's new president, Lula da Silva, has said his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, caused the crisis by paving the way for 20,000 illegal miners. Bolsonaro has denied responsibility, calling such accusations a, quote, left-wing farce. Brazil and Argentina are planning for greater economic integration, including the creation of a common currency. The announcement came as Brazilian President Lula da Silva visited Argentina on his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month.
The two biggest economies in South America are starting talks to create a common currency. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, and Argentina's president, Alberto Fernández, wrote in a joint piece published in Argentinian paper Perfil that they wanted to foster greater integration between the two neighbors. The pair said they had decided to move forward with discussions about a common South American currency that could be used for financial and commercial flows, reducing operating costs and other external vulnerability.
What we're trying to work on right now is to have our finance ministers, each with their economy teams and with a lot of debate and meetings, flow the foreign trade and transaction between the two countries with a common currency.
The announcement came as Lula has visited Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. At a press conference in Buenos Aires, he said establishing a common currency for trade would reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, whose sharp ascent last year was painful for countries around the world. Lula said, if it depended on me, we would have external commerce always in the same currency of the other countries so we wouldn't have to depend on the dollar. The Financial Times had previously reported, citing Argentina's economy minister, Sergio Massa, that the neighboring nations would announce this week they were starting work on a common currency. Massa indicated that though initially a bilateral project, the initiative would be offered to other nations in Latin America, adding it's Argentina and Brazil inviting the rest of the region. Argentina and Brazil are both part of the Mercosur trade bloc, which also includes Paraguay and Uruguay. Talk of creating a common currency has periodically cropped up since its founding in 1991. Brazil is Argentina's largest trade partner. It's the top destination for Argentine exports, amounting to 14.3% and $12.7 billion in 2022. Close to 20% of Argentina's imports are from Brazil, worth just over $16 billion last year. Emerging markets have also been hit hard by the strong U.S. dollar, drawing complaints about its dominance in the global financial system. The greenback rallied nearly 8% against a basket of major currencies in 2022, making imports of food and energy more expensive.
The imposition of U.S. trade restrictions and sanctions against a number of countries, including Russia, Iran, Cuba, North Korea, Iraq, and Syria, have been ineffective and backfired against Western economies. As a result, the U.S. dollar has been losing its role as a major currency in international trade transactions. This provides a unique opportunity for regional currencies and alternative payment systems to fill the vacuum, just like what Argentina and Brazil are planning to do.
Over 24 countries have been the target of unilateral or partial trade sanctions for not adhering to the policies of the U.S. and other Western powers. These limitations, nevertheless, have turned out to be detrimental to the economies of the group of seven nations and have begun to impact the U.S. dollar's hegemony in the world. The International Monetary Fund recorded a decline in central bank holdings of U.S. dollar reserves during the fourth quarter of 2020, which went from 71% to 59%, reflecting the U.S. dollar's waning influence on the world economy. And it continues to worsen. Evidence of this can be seen in the fact that the banking holdings of dollar claims have decreased from $7 trillion in 2021 to $6.4 trillion at the end of March 2022. According to an IMF report, the percentage of U.S. dollars in central bank reserves has decreased by 12% since 1999. While the percentage of other currencies, particularly the Chinese yuan, have shown an increasing trend with a 9% rise during this period. For instance, to boost global commerce and Indian exports, the Reserve Bank of India devised in July last year a rupee settlement mechanism to fend off pressure on the Indian currency. India has recently concluded agreements for currency exchanges of $75.4 billion with the UAE, Japan, and various South Asian nations. New Delhi has also informed South Korea and Turkey of its non-dollar mediated exchange rates for each country's currency. Currently, Turkey conducts business utilizing the national currency of China, yuan, and Russia, ruble. Iran has also proposed to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization euro-like SCO currency for trade among the Eurasian bloc to stop the weaponization of the U.S. dollar-dominated global financial system. Moscow and Beijing have already set up a cross-border interbank payment network similar to SWIFT, increased their gold purchases to give their currencies more stability, and signed agreements to swap national currencies in several regional and bilateral deals. The trend towards de-dollarization in international trade, particularly among the BRICS nations, has gained significant momentum in recent years. Together, they represent 41% of the world's population, 24% of its GDP, and 16% of its commerce. In 2015, the BRICS New Development Bank recommended the use of national currencies in trade. 4 years later, the bank provided 25% of its $15 billion in financial assistance in local currencies and plans to increase this to 50% in the coming years.
Moving on, North Korean authorities have ordered a five-day lockdown for the capital, Pyongyang, as the city is witnessing a rise in cases of an unspecified respiratory illness. South Korean news outlet reported the measure, citing a notice from the North Korean government. The notice didn't mention COVID-19, but said residents were required to stay indoors until Sunday. They also have to submit temperature checks multiple times every day. The outlet had earlier reported that Pyongyang residents were appeared to be stocking up food and other essentials in anticipation of stricter measures. Pyongyang had acknowledged its first coronavirus outbreak in 2022, but declared victory over the virus in October of the same year. The North has never confirmed the exact number of COVID cases and related deaths. Afghanistan is experiencing an exceptionally cold winter amid a severe economic crisis and major aid cuts in recent weeks. The volatile situation has put the lives of many in danger. Rahmatullah Bahman reports from Kabul.
Afghanistan is witnessing its coldest winter in 15 years, adding to the misery of millions who are already struggling with multiple crises. Umar Khan, a Kabul resident and a father of seven, lives in a cold shack. Two of his children are severely sick. Without a job and relief assistance, he has been unable to afford food, heating, and medication for his family. The situation has triggered fears of human losses.
As I told you, this son of mine collects plastic bottles and waste for one-time heating during the day. I was unemployed almost the entire year, and I couldn't afford fuel or winter clothes for my children. This other son is suffering from the disease of kidney stones. In such a situation, I'm afraid my children may go undernourished or freeze to death. This is a catastrophic moment, and I'm wondering what to do.
Meanwhile, the United Nations has put Afghanistan on its list of 11 crisis hotspots in 2023. The UN survey shows that two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, over 28 million people, need humanitarian aid. Heads of households, like Shah Gul, say they can't cope with the harsh winter alone.
We can't afford more than one meal per day. We used to buy some loaves of bread and potatoes, but today they're also gone from the table. We're not living a life in this cold room with no blanket or enough clothes. When the Taliban took power, everyone was saying that Afghanistan is going to see peace. But what about jobs, earning an income, and food? We need the Taliban administration and aid groups to reach out to us before we die from hunger or cold.
This comes as major aid groups have suspended their missions following the Taliban's ban on female workers. For many Afghans, the services provided by the NGOs were a lifeline that has been removed at the worst possible moment. Afghanistan is grappling with economic, political, and human rights crisis. Experts said the Taliban administration's restrictive measures, coupled with Western sanctions, are worsening the situation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of third-generation Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine, saying the move will be a blatant provocation against Moscow. Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Moscow. That's as the U.S. is poised to announce the start of the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. In the meantime, Germany is also about to pressure from Western allies and has agreed to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine. Both countries are expected to announce the decision later today. In a video address, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Martyrdom of Imam Hadi, peace upon him. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam, dear friends, and heartfelt condolences to you on a very doleful day. Today is the third of the month of Rajab, on which the Prophet of Islam's 10th infallible heir was poisoned to martyrdom in the Iraqi city of Samarra by the usurper Abbasid regime. He was Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi, peace upon him, who was the source of blessing for the seekers of truth. Please stay with us for a special feature in this regard. Whoever expects to meet Allah, Allah's time will indeed come, and He is the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. What you heard was Ayah 5 of Surah Ankabut of the Noble Quran, in which the word meet or meeting gives the feeling of close proximity to God, who, however, is far glorious to have any shape, form, and place, all three of which signify limits and restrictions, and thus against the nature of the source of all creation. In view of these facts, whoever strives on the path of virtue, prays, fasts, abstains from undesirable things, acts, and sights definitely feels proximity with the Lord Most High. But the first and foremost condition for this proximity or meeting is faith. In other words, it is faith based on firm conviction and in accordance with the description of the omnipresent Lord by his last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Here is an interesting hadith from the Prophet on meeting with the Lord, of course not physical, and the conditions stipulated for any such proximity. It reads, "He who desires to meet Allah on the day of resurrection, safe, purified, and without fearing the great horror, let him know, follow you, O Ali, and follow your two sons, Hassan and Hussein, and after them your infallible descendants, Ali ibn al-Hussein, Muhammad ibn Ali, Ja'far ibn Muhammad, Musa ibn Ja'far, Ali ibn Musa, Muhammad ibn Ali, Ali ibn Muhammad, Hassan ibn Ali, and Al-Mahdi, the last of them." The hadith is lengthy and elaborates on the benefits of love, affection, and obedience for the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, whom the Prophet, on the express orders of God Almighty, had proclaimed as his vicegerent on the 18th of Dhul-Hajjah at Qadir Khum while returning from his farewell Hajj pilgrimage. The important point is that the Prophet clearly specified by name the successors of his divinely designated heir, because he knew that a group of his disobedient companions would usurp the political right of leadership of Imam Ali, peace upon him, by depriving the Ahlul Bayt of the caliphate, which would be empties of its spirituality by the unprincipled, the immoral, the unjust, and the ungodly. No wonder the narrator of this wonderful hadith from the Prophet that emphasizes the chain of authority in Islam is a member of this elite group itself. He is Imam Ali al-Hadi, peace upon him, the Prophet's 10th infallible successor, whose martyrdom anniversary we commemorate tomorrow on Friday, the 3rd of the sacred month of Rajab. This representative of the blessed event of Qadir Khum was a victim of a person who traced his questionable political rule to the scandalous gathering Saqifah Bani Sa'idah in Medina no sooner the Prophet had left the mortal world. Since Imam Hadi, peace upon him, was the Prophet's legitimate heir and one of the 12 persons whose obedience ensures proximity and meeting with Almighty Allah, the Caliph placed him under house arrest so that Muslims would be deprived of the chance to meet him and subsequently be deprived of proximity to God. Nonetheless, despite the restrictions placed upon him, the 10th Imam continued his enlightening task, and at every opportunity he expounded the Ummah the genuine teachings of his illustrious ancestor, the Prophet, such as the above-mentioned hadith. Thus, to make sure that people will always have access to the chosen of God, long after the disgraceful institution called the Caliphate vanishes from the scene, Imam Hadi, peace upon him, bequeathed gems of guidance for the faithful concerning his grandson, the promised savior of humanity, Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. A famous statement from Imam Hadi, peace upon him, gives an important piece of advice to the Muslims to save them from deviation. It reads, during the ghaybat of your qa'im, the 12th Imam, a group of the ulama will call people to believe in his imamat and defend his creed by citing proofs revealed by Allah in order to save the weak-minded from either the deceptions of the Satan and his hordes or the deceptions of Imam Ali's enemy. In the absence of such ulama, everyone would have strayed away from the religion decreed by Allah. Thus, as the pilot holds the rudder of the ship, these ulama will hold firmly unto the hearts of the Shiites. For example, a steadfast adherence of the Prophet's household, preventing them from straying. Such ulama are the most excellent in the sight of Allah the Exalted. Imam Hadi, peace upon him, whose imamat could be divided into two parts, 17 years in Medina and 17 years in Samarra, where he was under house arrest by the Abbasid regime, groomed Muslims for the ghaybat, or period of occultation, of his yet-to-be-born grandson, the 12th Imam, who will rise in the end times as Mahdi al-Qa'im, peace upon him. Imam Mahdi will cleanse the earth of corruption and oppression by establishing the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. In view of the guidance of posterity, the 10th Imam groomed a great many ulama, who through a solid chain of succession have kept alive the aspirations of the faithful till this day, over a millennium and almost two centuries later. At the same time, in that politically volatile period, when uprisings frequently rocked Abbasid rule from Khorasan in the east to North Africa in the west, mostly by descendants of the Prophet, he strengthened the foolproof system of wakalat, or representation, to enable the faithful in the furthest parts of the realm to keep in constant contact without detection by the regime. All this he did for the sake of facilitating the path of the faithful for meeting or proximity with Allah. Perhaps one of the most wonderful intellectual and scientific traditions transmitted from Imam, the 10th Imam, is the letter that he sent to the people of Ahwaz in Iran, in which he refuted the concept of compulsion that the Ash-Shariat school adopted and spread, claiming that human beings are compelled into actions and have no will or option. In contrast to compulsion, the Imam also refuted the concept of free will that the Mu'tazilites believed in. After refuting these two concepts, Imam Hadi, peace upon him, proved with irrefutable scientific proofs the concept of the matter between the two matters of compulsion and free will, as taught by the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. Here are some excerpts of the epistle of Imam Hadi, peace upon him, to the people of Ahwaz. Your letter came to me, and I understood what you mentioned of your disagreement in your religion. Your plunging in the matter of faith, the belief of some of you in compulsion and others in free will, and the disagreement, separation, and enmity among you because of that. The Ummah agrees unanimously with no disagreement that the Quran is the truth that has no doubts in it for Muslims of all sects. The Quran is the truth that there is no difference between Muslims in its revelation and truthfulness. So, when the Quran testifies the truthfulness of some news, but a group of the Ummah denies it, they have actually deemed themselves as outcasts from the Muslim Ummah. In other words, the Imam meant to say that Muslims must refer to the Quran, to which falsehood shall not come from any direction. The Quran is the truth, and that which contradicts it is falsehood. Whoever believes this falsehood will be out of Islam, he added. The first news that is proved, witnessed, and confirmed by the book is the saying of the Messenger of Allah, I leave you the Thaqalain, that is the book of Allah and my household. You shall not go astray as long as you hold fast to them. They shall not separate even when they shall come to me at the pond in paradise. We found the evidences of this hadith in the book of Allah, where Allah said, Only Allah is your guardian and his messenger, and those who believe, those who keep up prayer and pay the poor rate while they bow. And whoever takes Allah and his messenger and those who believe for a guardian, then surely the party of Allah, Hezbollah, shall be triumphant. All Muslim sects have narrated that this ayah, which is 55 of Surah Ma'idah, was revealed when Imam Ali, peace upon him, had given his ring as charity while he was bowing in prayer, and Allah praised him for that and revealed this verse. We found the hadith of the Messenger of Allah saying, Whoever I was his guardian, Ali is to be his guardian. And you are to me as was Aaron to Moses, but there will be no prophet after me. And Ali repays my debts, carries out my promises, and he is my caliph over you after me. The tradition clearly indicated the caliphate of Imam Ali, peace upon him, after the mission of prophets, and that there was no one worthier of the prophets than Imam Ali, peace upon him, the pioneer of intellectual and civilizational development in the earth. Thus, on the basis of these undeniable facts, Imam Hadi, peace upon him, refuted the ideas of both the groups, whether those claiming compulsion and those claiming free will. Thus, through debates and rational explanation of the noble Quran and the genuine hadith of the Prophet, the 10th Imam enlightened many of the Muslims and saved them from disbelief. We once again offer our condolences to you, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hadi, peace upon him.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Football is one of the most lucrative businesses in our time. Not many industries can overtake it. Football is the most powerful non-media phenomenon in the world. All tycoons and influential people want to have control over it. Football is the most important news in the world. All cameras are fixed on the green field. Think about it a little. What can you find in this world that's not tied to football? We can't shut our eyes. Football is everywhere. It's so conspicuous and omnipresent that you cannot deny it. Fans and spectators, the strongest impetus for football. Just imagine for a moment what would have happened if football didn't enjoy such a huge popular support. This is a rule. The larger the number of the people who are engaged in a phenomenon, the more significant the phenomenon will be. Football gets its power from the cheering of the fans. But why do people become fans? Wherever in the world 22 people run after a ball, some spectators will definitely show up. In some places, fewer people, and in some other places, more people. And sometimes, there is such a huge crowd of spectators and fans that it hinders the match. For example, in the final match of the knockout games in Britain in 1923, over 300,000 people stormed the stadium. Many other matches in the history of the sport had so many spectators that they had to sit up to the sidelines. Fans, whether it's stadiums or in front of TV screens or monitors, will be an integral part of matches and events related to them. They jump up and down, they cry, they shout and get mad as far as getting a heart attack. They swear, they fight, they cause mayhem, and sometimes they even get killed. The spectators cheer their favorite teams and players and give them energy. Sometimes they do it so well, it leads to a comeback. The spectators boo the rival team's players and make them nervous. Even if it's necessary, they disrupt the games. As it's always said, they're the 12 players of their team. That's why all players and coaches share their happiness with them, because football spectators are
are not just watchers of a sports match. For those who watch matches under scorching heat or heavy snow, football is no joke. They love football. But what do people want from football? Why do they arrange everything in their lives based on football? The first answer is this: entertainment. Football is the best entertainment in the world. You only need to watch it to feel the miracle, the beauty of the techniques, the excitement of the sideline issues, the amazing tactics, and eventually, the display of fate. You can find everything in football. Everything you need for happiness, sadness, surprise, or excitement. Even in the most boring matches, there are things that will make you remember them for weeks. After all, people always want to be entertained. That's why they watch movies or go on vacations or do thousands of other things. Football gives them this gift. What's more entertaining than being at a stadium and watching the most beautiful sport by mankind? But more importantly is the feeling of it. When people enter the stadium, they become members of a big society, a group with the same flag and colors, with the same slogans, the same goal, the same idea, and the same wish. You become united with thousands of people at the stadiums who sing the same song or laugh and cry for the same thing. It satisfies one of human beings' most basic needs, the tendency to socialize, the need to be united with others, the instinct to communicate with a group without the usual expenses for social relationships. Being a part of a coordinated society is the best feeling in the world. It's a feeling of sameness and cordiality, a feeling of esprit de corps. And the third reason is what we call catharsis.
Most amazing Champions League night this great crowd has ever seen. It's the greatest ever semi-final comeback in the history of the competition. Liverpool are into the final, and we will never ever forget quite how they did it.
Catharsis is the feeling the audience gets after listening to a masterpiece symphony or watching an impressive play. It's a kind of revolution inside you. It's a kind of spiritual experience. Football is a small example of our life. So merciless, so beautiful, and so fair. The most sorrowful tragedies along with surprises, achievements, and epics. The biggest protagonists next to the most detested antagonists in the most spectacular clashes. Watching football makes you feel that you're part of a bigger experience. A part of the common experience by human beings whose identity is exactly similar to our life. The experience of watching a good match is just like watching a play by Shakespeare. You have a strange feeling afterwards, a kind of pleasant lightness. People watch football for these things. The importance of the spectators can't be realized anywhere as much as in the World Cup. The World Cup is the most important event in the world of football.
It's a headline of all the media in the world. Billions of people across the world watch it. All nations follow it. That's why a national team's participation in the World Cup is the biggest dream for its fans. They support their teams months ahead of the games, in World Cup qualification games, in friendlies, in practice sessions, and even at the airports. They're always everywhere, and they accompany their teams in the breathtaking path towards the World Cup. If a country's national team isn't used to regularly taking part in the World Cup, they hold large celebrations on the streets after qualification. Fans boost the players' spirits along the way to prepare for the World Cup. And they get ready and go to the stadiums on the other side of the planet to shout their country's names and support the players. This is a climax of human beings' love for football. Fans at stadiums are draped with their country's flags. Sometimes they paint their faces as a color of their flags. Sometimes they even bring symbols of their country and history to the stadiums. And it doesn't stop there. They have bizarre devices for cheering, sing long songs out loud. They have similar appearances and fantasy designs. It all turns the World Cup into a passionate and colorful carnival of different cultures. It's a chance for dialogue among civilizations, languages, religions, and human beings. The performance of the fans is the most representative of their nation's cultures. Japanese and South Korean fans are well-disciplined, indefatigable, and coordinated. Brazilians are full of energy and joy, and they never stop cheering their team. And the Britain's strategy to cheer their players is exactly what's dragged other nations into conflicts. The different cultures and approaches of cheering will be in the minds of everyone in the world for many years. It'll somehow become an image from the people in that country in the minds of the people in the world. As everyone knows the tiny country of Iceland with their fans' unique cheering, or the Vuvuzelas in the 2010 World Cup quickly found their ways to football matches everywhere in the world, or the Mexican wave, which has been ongoing in big stadiums since 1986. Apart from all of these, World Cup fans have another major characteristic as well. They gather under the same national flag. Their most important goal is to support their national pride and gaining pride for the flag. The flag isn't tied to the identity of any club or individual. When a club loses, its fans might get upset for months, but when a national team loses, a country loses. Millions of people's national pride and their sports credibility are hurt. To be honest, the World Cup is a peaceful example of wars that's been fought between countries for centuries. Nowadays, countries don't fight each other with their missiles. They line up with their players and fans. Everything is like wars in the past. 11 players as fighters at the forefront and tens of thousands of fans as infantry behind them. The goal is to hoist the flag that covers all of them. Just think about the match between Argentina and Britain in the 1986 World Cup and what it meant for thousands of Argentine spectators at the Estadio Azteca in Mexico 4 years after their defeat in the Falklands War. Then you'll realize the crazy excitement of the spectators at the stadium. Or think about the spectators of the match between Iran and the U.S. at the Guerlain Stadium and how they felt when both nations' flags were raised side by side. This is the main factor that differentiates spectators in a World Cup match from an ordinary match. The former aren't looking for excitement, they're looking for honor. They're trying to display their nation's culture. They're trying to immerse in the shadow of the flag to which they owe many things. The history of the World Cup is replete with spectators that if it wasn't for them, nothing in these matches would look like what it is now. The spectators are the soul of the World Cup. Think about July 16, 1950, the final match with the largest number of spectators in history, when 200,000 Brazilian spectators were cheering their team like mad. When the biggest tragedy in the history of the country's football happened. Later on, in the 1970 World Cup, being a spectator had the meaning we know today. In most of the matches, over 80,000 people were at the stadiums, and some of them over 120,000 people. Many of them were foreigners. The huge numbers of spectators changed the face of many things. Television networks were now interested in broadcasting the matches. If the World Cup could take thousands of people from all across the world to a country, then why wouldn't it make millions of people sit in front of TV screens? Meanwhile, the large crowds would put a huge pressure on the referees in a way that the referees would make strange mistakes in favor of the hosts. It was that year when the world realized that the presence of so many spectators would give their country's tourism industry a boost. The high numbers of spectators changed the history of the World Cup. Now, the spectators were not just people who were sitting on the sidelines to watch the matches. They were an important part of the competition. They could impact everything. When Austria and Germany played in 1982 in a match that was suspected to be a match-fixing, the fans at the stadium found out about it. They got so angry that they showed the players of both teams banknotes throughout the match as a sign of protests. Some of them even set their national flags on fire. The protests drew everyone's attention to the historical scandal. In the following years, in the final matches of the 1990 World Cup, the Italian spectators piled so much pressure on Maradona, who had defeated their team, to disturb him so he couldn't display his best show. Grabbed the cup from Argentina and gave it to Germany. When Maradona was shedding tears with a silver medal around his neck, the Italians seemed satisfied. And in the 2002 World Cup, we witnessed how South Korean fans pushed the referees to the most horrible mistakes. In fact, in the hell that the South Korean fans made, it was very hard not to make any mistakes. And today, World Cup spectators are not that different from the spectators 80 years ago. They're still so fanatic, so passionate about victory, and so excited. But something has changed. Now, the cameras turn to show them as well besides the field. The spectators who are sitting near the sidelines, despite their variety and large numbers, show the true meaning of the World Cup.
And we will go to penalties. And he's done it! And England win on penalties! It is Russia's time!
Fans go to the World Cup from all over the world. They stand by their teams and wholeheartedly shout for their victory. They represent their nations and countries just as much as the players do. They hold a flag that's a symbol of their identity and do their best for their honor and to make everyone feel proud. And this is what our world looks like. The world of the competition between different colors, ideas, and tastes. The world of the urge to win. The world